This evening we're talking about an autobiography, Lillian Gish, The Movies, Mr. Griffith and Me. It is published by Prentice Hall, written, of course, by Lillian Gish, and we will return to Miss Gish in just a moment.
This is BookBeat, each week introducing you to leading authors and critics. This program is made possible with the cooperation of the National Book Committee and the American Booksellers Association. Your host is Robert Cromie, book editor of the Chicago Tribune and a contributing editor to Book World, the Sunday literary supplement of the Chicago Tribune and the Washington Post.
Miss Gish, you have given D.W. Griffith such a major part of this book that it's almost as much a biography of him as it is your autobiography. Why did you do this?
It started out as a book about him. I hope it's much more about him than about me. At least Prentice Hall, when they, what do they call it, wrapped the book up? They said, now, this is not your story. Mr. Griffith is always center stage. We would like to sign a contract with you now to do your story. Well, we were on the 13th floor, and I looked at the window and wondered which I'd rather do, jump out or start another book.
Well, still, why did you think it was necessary to give him this much in your book?
He's the only American that ever created an art form. And it's the only American art form to which we have any claim.
Was he the first movie director? Or the first good movie director?
He came into films when they were little more than photograph stage plays. And the camera stayed way out there and you saw the full figure. Sometimes you could hardly see that figure. It would be on one side or another. The people meant nothing to you. The camera didn't move. It was just photographed stage play with titles. And he took this crude thing and wrote the formula that we use today for everything that is called a motion picture or television as a first cousin. It's the same thing on a smaller scale.
Well, was the close-up his?
No, they had had the close-up, but didn't know how to use it. Mm-hmm. He evolved the different ways of using a close-up, of using the camera, of using everything that would tell a story. He did come from the theater, but it dawned on him when he was in charge that he was not under a proscenium arch. His arch was the sun, moon, and stars. He could think of Christmas and television, the other side of the moon, and those words that came back to thrill the world. He must have envisioned that even then.
Well, he upset the people over him, didn't he, by the techniques he used and the innovations he used. I mean, they were afraid that the public wouldn't go for them.
Oh, often hit the business people who didn't understand it. They didn't want the actor cut in two. They wanted all of him. They paid for all of him. Why only use his? Cut him off at the neck or in the middle.
He demonstrated that actually they, when they looked at someone, he moved up very close, didn't he, to the person who objected and said, look, you only see half of me now.
But he wanted the audience to see the people thinking.
Yeah, but I mean, in explaining why he did it to the man who was criticizing, he moved up very close and said, well, you only see half of me. You don't realize it, but this is what the camera does. So he reasoned with the critics of his camera technique.
Well, the only critics that really mattered were the men with the purse strings that financed it, and they always complained. Every new innovation, it was wrong. But he went ahead just the same, and after 500 pictures made from 1908 to 1913, he had evolved the technique. He enlarged on it, but all the things he used later, for instance, in The Birth of a Nation or Hearts of the World, had been tested and used, and he had gradually come up to the point that he could make a 12-reel film and hold an audience, that he thought he could make an 8-hour film and hold an audience, which he could have
in
Intolerance.
Intolerance, yeah.
That was his monument. That's the greatest picture, I believe, that's ever been made, and I think anyone that knows the films will acquiesce to that.
But they didn't let him do it. They wouldn't let him show it.
No, the exhibitors said they wouldn't put it in their theaters. And unfortunately, he listened to them. But because they would have.
You had seen it. You saw it as an 8-hour show.
Yes.
And you liked it very much.
Oh, yes, it was. It didn't confuse an audience. It was four separate stories, big stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you and your sister, of course, Dorothy, got into the theater with your mother when you were three and Dorothy was two, or you were four and Dorothy was three, something
well,
like that?
Well, we were about that very early age. We were put on stage before I remember, or we either one could read, or we were taught to speak the lines loudly and clearly, or they would get another little girl. It was just that definite.
And you had to hide from the Gary Society.
Oh, yes. They made life miserable for us. They never told us the boogeyman would get us. It was the Gary Society man would get you, put you in a big stone castle away from your mother. We couldn't imagine anything worse than that.
They were supposed to stop children from working, weren't they, the Gary
yes,
Society?
Yes, foolishly. Children yeah. should work. It's good for them. Gives them a sense of responsibility. And to earn their own living is an insurance for a later, happier life.
Oh, well, I think of it. Tell me about your sister, Dorothy. The time she sat in the fireplace.
Oh. Well, she adored a leading man called Fisk O'Hara. She played 3 years in three different plays that Ann Nichols wrote for him. She later wrote Abie's Irish Rose that broke
yes.
all
mm-hmm.
records, if you remember. And he had promised her he'd wait until she grew up and would marry her. So
how old was she then?
Seven when this started. It was nine. She was nine when she loved to watch him on stage, and she had a scene in a nightgown. And there was no place in this small theater and backstage that she could go in the wings and watch him. So she peeked down through the fireplace, and she got so interested, she finally slipped in and sat on the logs that had a red light under them, and it was supposed to be burning, and the audience started to laugh and laugh louder, and he looked at the leading woman to see if she was all right, and then he turned his back and looked to see if he was all right, and then finally looked around the stage, and he said, "For heaven's sakes, get the kid out of the fireplace."
That would have been one of the high moments of my theatrical viewing. I think I would like to have seen that.
Well, I think the intentness on her face must have been amusing.
Well, you and Mr. Griffith became acquainted through Grace, what was the real name? Smith. No, not
Gladys Smith.
Gladys Smith, yes. Who, of course, was Mary Pickford later.
Mary Pickford later.
But how did he happen to take you and Dorothy on as actresses?
Well, he liked people from the theater, and we had had experience in asked if we could act, and Dorothy said, "We are of the legitimate theater," very proudly. And he said, "I don't mean reading lines, I mean act." Well, we were a little flabbergasted at that. We didn't know what he was referring to, and he said, "Come upstairs, I'll soon find out." And he rehearsed a melodrama up there. And the climax was firing a gun at the two figures, and he took a real little pistol out of his pocket and started shooting at the ceiling and chasing us around, and we were sure we were in a crazy house. But there was a Lionel Barrymore, a Barrymore in the company, so we thought it couldn't be too bad or he wouldn't be there. And he afterwards gave us a job.
And you needed the $5 a day, too.
Yes, we did indeed. Our salaries up until then had been $10 a week.
Well, your mother, of course, didn't act in the movies, did she?
Yes, now and again, but not if she could help it. Mm-hmm. It was nothing that, to her taste.
But after your father left, she worked ran a candy store for a while, didn't she?
Only in the summertime.
And was sort of.
And then in the winter, we would be in the theater, but it was hard to save enough money from our small salary to live through.
But
the
they
summer.
Would farm you out, you and Dorothy. She would let actress friends of hers who needed a girl
yes.
in the company take you for the season.
Mm-hmm. They would be Aunt Alice or Aunt Dolores. Or mm-hmm. We'd be billed as Baby Alice or Baby Lillian, or sometimes just herself or himself, as a dog or a cat would be billed.
Well, how many movies did you make with Mr. Griffith?
Oh, I wouldn't know. I worked with him directly, I suppose, three and a half years. I was in his company and worked with other directors and learned a great deal that way because I was on my own.
Well, now, he was on top of the movie world for a few years. What happened? Why did he become actually a failure in the end? I don't mean his an artistic failure, but I mean he couldn't get jobs and people wouldn't let him direct anymore.
It was hard for him to follow trends. He always made a story, did a story, because he had something to say, or it was out of yesterday's newspaper or today's. He had a great range of subjects that interested him. He did Pippa Passes, he'd do poetry, he did Thomas Burke's Limehouse Night story of the chink and the child and turned it into a tragic poem called Broken Blossoms. And then the businessmen came in. If he had had any business sense, his first long film cost $61,000, made over $100 million. If he had been able to keep what his film made, he would have had enough to make pictures for as long as he lived. But he had no business sense whatsoever.
Which film was that now?
The Birth of a Nation.
Birth of a Nation. That was his first long one.
Yes.
And that was a very controversial film, and still is, I guess, for that matter.
Yes. So was Orphans of the Storm on the French Revolution in France. Everything he seemed to touch was controversy. Broken Blossoms had an Englishman as a villain, and they didn't like that in England. He said, well, I suppose we'll have to use American white men because they do admit that there are a few bad ones among them.
Well, and Orphans, you had a scene in which you had to lie on an ice floe.
That was way down east.
Well, that was way down east, wasn't it? Well, does your arm still hurt is what I was leading up to, your hand?
It was the hand that got so cold it was like holding it in a flame to hold it in ice water.
You dragged it in the water just as a touch.
I thought it would be affecting
a bit of business,
to see the hair in the hand. She faints on the ice floe. And we were 3 weeks up in White River Junction, Vermont, in the below zero weather, filming this. From sun up till sundown, it was an endurance test.
Well, you actually were in some danger of going over a kind of a falls, too, when you were finally rescued, weren't you?
Oh, just a miracle that we escaped. I think we had an old character man with us called Lestina, who always claimed that God looked after actors. And when that happened, I was sure he was right.
Well, was it Richard Barthelmess who
went
leaping from floe to floe?
And he got so excited, he thought he couldn't get there, and he fell accidentally. And that delayed it even more, so that it, from my point of view, it was too late.
Would you have actually gone over and
done
something? Oh,
I might. I could have been killed with the ice coming over and back of me, or at best, injured.
Yes. Well, you, of course, have been the leading lady with some very, very memorable leading men, including Ronald Colman, who was always one of my favorites.
Yes, he was a charming gentleman. He had his first big part with me in The White Sister, and it was the first American film ever to be made in Italy with him. And we were a year in Rome, and the next year we took him again to Florence, and also William Powell, long film, and made George Eliot's Romola, 15th century Florentine story. Fell so in love with the Italian workmen and their sets and the 15th century beauty that I'm afraid we made her story rather dull.
How many years were you in the films now?
I think 17 or 18 years when I was actually making films. And then when they started to talk, I thought I'd best, if I was going to use a voice, use it under a proscenium arch, not in a tin can, because the voices were not very good. And they came to me and said, well, you're very lucky. You have a whole new career ahead of you with talking pictures. Now we'll redo all your old films. Well, that was the least interesting or exciting thing I could think of. Instead, we had a wonder boy in the theater at that time called Jed Harris.
Mm.
and he sent Uncle Vanya. Chekhov had not been done much in our theater, and of course I accepted with deep gratitude that I should go back to the theater under such auspices.
Well, when did you and Georgie Jean Nathan meet?
That was around in the middle 20s. He had written a beautiful thing in Vanity Fair, that magazine.
Yes, I remember,
that
very well.
Frank
yes.
Croningshield. A most flattering article about me, and he was the last person I wanted to meet because I was afraid of anyone that said anything good about me. If they'd meet me, they'd change their minds. And I got on a train to go to visit Hergesheimer, our author, you know.
Joseph
Hergesheimer. And who should be on the train going to the same place but Mr. Nathan? There was no escaping.
Well, and you and he were very great friends for...
Yes, he taught me a great deal about the theater. And he was a wonderful man insofar, if you had a scene, as in Uncle Vanya, he could tell you how it was treated, the same scene, the same subject in 10 or 12 other plays by other authors. And he had great knowledgeability about the theater.
Was that the play that he advised you to get out of because one of the other actresses had such a very good speech that he said she'll cut you to pieces? You know, she'll...
It was Uncle Vanya.
That was Uncle Vanya.
He had read the first act and the second, and I think the third act came after we'd been 2 weeks in rehearsal. And Sonia had a beautiful long speech. I played Elena. And he said, you can't do this play. And I said, well, I said I'd do it. I hadn't signed anything. He said, you can't hold your own against that long speech of Sonia's. And I said, well, then I'm sorry, I can't. But I'm in it. We've rehearsed 2 weeks. I can't leave it. He said, you'll never get another job again as long as you live if you do. And that gave me great confidence, I may add, to come into the American theater. And at that time, New York and Hollywood were enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to come in under another name. But they said, no, they'll know you. Well, I thought, you know, after being in close-ups in films and you were so far away in the theater, they might not recognize me.
When was this? Was this in the 20s?
Or 30s.
In the 30s. Of course, he wanted to marry you, didn't he? George Jean Nathan.
Well, he told a lot of people. I didn't tell that.
You said it in your book.
Because he told Mr. Atkinson and many people, and it didn't seem... what do they say about kiss and tell? You mustn't do that. Men or women.
Let's get back to D.W. Griffith, because the end of his life... Was there any happiness in it? He got married, which I think made him happy.
He had a dear wife.
This was in Louisville.
Yes, the last wife was a dear woman. But... He was not a domesticated animal. He only knew how to work. And he worked 7 days a week, 14, 16 hours a day. He hadn't any means of using leisure. And when his work was taken away from him, he was lost.
Well, how many years was he trying to make to direct another movie and really couldn't find anybody who would let him? He called you from London once and asked you to be in a thing from London.
He was remaking Broken Blossoms in London. And I don't know why he made his first talking picture in 20 or 21, you know, and discarded it. I think maybe he didn't believe in the art form. It was not a pure thing. It was an illegitimate, a bastard art form, whereas the silent films that could be articulate and understood around the world without a word,
mm-hmm.
was a true, a new vision he had. And perhaps it was his deep disappointment when just as they were reaching a point of maturity, they should switch to words instead of going to music. He liked the musicals. And he liked the good talking pictures, and there were many. But he saw things in another way. He believed words belonged in the theater. He wanted, really, his ambition was to be the American Shakespeare, write beautiful plays. He went back to it. after films, but I guess a man isn't given two talents.
Hmm. Well, you say in your book that that you think maybe the reason that his directing career went into a decline was that at first he was asking everybody in the company for ideas,
yes.
And if they were good, he took them, and it was a sort of a cooperative venture. And then later, apparently he was expected to do it all by himself, and it just didn't seem to work out so well.
Well, I think the reason he asked people, he knew that he had to play to people like this. He wanted to get various opinions. And in those days, pictures were made so fast you couldn't follow up and watch the audiences.
Did they have a script?
Never had a script for anything. That's why Intolerance is such a magnificent film, when you consider that a man wrote it all, designed all the sets, all he had were carpenters, designed all the costumes, did all the research for the history of Babylon, for the crucifixion, for the eve of St. Bartholomew in France, and up to the turn of the century, the battle between capital and labor here.
And he had to keep that in his mind.
And it was all in this man's mind, nothing ever written. The only man that had it on paper was the cutter, who had to know when the film came through where it belonged.
And you were responsible for remembering your costumes when you came back to a scene.
Oh, everyone had to be responsible. If you went out of the door here, and maybe a month later you were up in the mountains in the snow and came outside, you had to remember how your hair was, what you had in your right hand or left. And if you couldn't do that, they had to get someone else. No one was there. Now they take a picture of everything, you know.
How do you remember the movies of those days as against the movies of today? Would you rather have been in them then? Of course, you still are. You just did The Comedians not long ago, or the Graham Greene movie, or a Graham Greene book. You've never really been out.
Oh, yes. When I was really in movies, I was responsible for my story, for my cast, for my photography.
You even directed.
And I directed a film, and it cured me. I never directed a second one.
But was it more fun in those days than it is now?
No, it was harder because we had no help. Now every director has a scenic designer. He has a costume designer. We had nothing.
No, but I mean, was
we
it
had
more,
a cameraman.
More rewarding in those days to be an actress?
Oh, there was a certain spirit that's gone. It was only the film that was important, the finished picture. You weren't important. No one was, but what was up there on the screen. That was all-powerful. As a prime minister of England had told Mr. Griffith, that he had the most powerful medium over men's minds that had ever been seen in the history of the world, far beyond the printing press. Well, those are big words.
Yeah,
and we were young children, in a way. We believed them.
When he finally died, Hollywood then remembered him again, didn't it?
In a way. Not as much as other countries.
No, but I mean as far as the funeral went, all the people who
I wasn't there, I don't know.
You couldn't make it, no, you were working.
I was playing in the East in a play.
But you went to a memorial service for him afterwards.
Well, then the Screenwriters Guild got together and furnished or had made a marble slab for over his grave in just outside Louisville. And his wife and Mary Pickford and Richard Barthelmess and a few others went down for that dedication.
You were there. Was Dorothy there, too?
I think she was in England at the time and couldn't come.
Tell me about the one-woman thing you have put together, kind of a history of the movies.
Yes, I call it an illustrated lecture. It's an hour and 14 minutes of film, all kinds of film, from 1900 to 1928.
All American?
No, French. And not all the people, we couldn't in an hour and 14 minutes, but you see the evolution of this as an art form.
And you comment on it as the film
and
is
I
shown.
And I speak over the running of the film.
And
we tried it out at the film festival in San Francisco at UCLA, and we were at Columbia the night of the riot, April 17th. We didn't cause the riot.
What's the response?
The press were there. It was amazing to me because, and now Mrs. Langner of the Theatre Guild has seen it four times, and she wants to book it across country for the Theatre Guild. Also, I want to take it to the universities where they teach film. I think it will be useful there. But I will tour it. I come here to the Goodman Theatre the 30th of September with it.
Oh, good. But what about the kids who have never seen these old movies? There must be many of them in the audience. How do they like them?
You'd be amazed at how many more youngsters have seen them than the middle ones.
Is that right?
It's true. They know more about them. So many families buy these films. They are for sale. And put a machine in the room to wean their children away from the violence of television.
Mm.
And the children, running them over and over again, become so curious. They write and want to know how it was done, when it was done, where it was done. So I'm glad I have a book to answer all that now.
What do you think about the new freedom in expression and in action on both the stage and in the films?
I think it's a phase we're going through.
But I mean, does it offend you? Do you object to it?
I think it's boring and dull. And I believe in the taste of people to the extent that I think they won't fill the theaters, and that's what they're made for. And if they don't, we'll have something better, I hope.
Well, the star system is gone, too, pretty much now, hasn't it?
I don't know that it ever existed, that a star...
You were a star. You were a great one.
I don't believe in that. You know what Griffith said to us when we thought a star was something with its name up in lights? And he says, you think that makes you a star? You see hundreds of little boys and girls come and go every year, and they have their name up in lights. That has nothing to do with it. When you're a household word in every family of the world, you will be a star. That will take you at least 10, maybe 20 years. You will have to make the most perfect pictures during that time. Well, he painted such a black picture. We thought we didn't want to be that.
Well, you made it. We've been talking with Lillian Gish, author of Lillian Gish, The Movies, Mr. Griffith and Me, a very nostalgic look at Mrs. Gish's career and, of course, her sister Dorothy Gish and the people who were with them in those days. I'm Bob Cromie from the Tribune. Thank you for being with us. I hope you're with us again next week. Thank you.